The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to another episode of Negotiate Anything. Thanks for spending time with us today. It's listeners like you in 181 different countries that have made Negotiate Anything the most popular negotiation and conflict resolution podcast in the world. I'm your host, Kwame Christian. I'm a business lawyer, mediator, professor, and the director of the American Negotiation Institute. Before we get started, I have two quick questions for you. Is negotiation a critical part of what you do? Do you need to resolve conflict and persuade at work? If you answered yes to both of those questions, visit our website to learn more about our negotiation workshops. We've traveled the country working with professionals just like you, and we'd love to have the opportunity to work with you too. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Humphrey, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Kwame, thanks for having me on. Really excited to be on here.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to have you. I mean, it's been a while since I've actually seen you, so it's good to see your face again.
Definitely.
How about you get us started? Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. My name is Humphrey Rekul. I live in Nairobi, Kenya. I work for a company called Cross Boundary, which is an investment firm that's really mission-driven and impact-focused, and it's focused really on harnessing the power of capital to make a return and a lasting impact in frontier markets. And so a lot of that's in Africa, but really globally, honestly. And so And what I do at Cross Boundary is I'm on a team called Cross Boundary Energy Access. So what we focus on is financing mini grids. So if you're not familiar with what mini grids are, they are they're essentially standalone electric systems that are able to bring power to communities that don't have electricity. So think you have a community, think about 300 houses off the beaten path. A mini grid company will come out there. To build a mini grid, they'll bring solar panels. It can be other technology, but typically solar. So solar panels, some batteries for storage, a backup generator to make sure they have 24/7 power, put poles in the ground, wires, meters on people's houses, connect them, and all of a sudden they've built a mini version of the utility grid that you might be used to, and those 300 houses are their customers, and then they go a few miles down the road and do it again. And so these things really have the potential to make a huge impact on the continent. If you look in Africa, about 1.2 billion people, and almost half of them, 600 million people, do not have access to electricity. And we know that these mini grids are the least cost way of bringing power to well over 100 million of them, but they're quite difficult to finance. And so what we work on is trying to find a way to bring finance at scale into this sector and put the money into these mini grids and make the impact that's necessary with a commercial focus.
That's fantastic. And I think what's interesting about this is that for a lot of listeners, they might see this as some kind of goodwill mission, right? Okay, we see people in need, we're going to bring the energy to them. Now they're in a better position. But what's interesting about this is that it's not just that you're doing great work and helping people. There's also the financial part of it. This is a legitimate business, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And so it's a legitimate business in a lot of different ways, right? You have mini grid developers, companies that are going out there and actually building these things and getting mini grid customers, individual homes in rural communities across Africa as their customers who pay them by the kilowatt hour or some other means for electricity. At the same time, from our perspective, we realize that in order for the finance to really scale here, you need the private sector. There are areas where there's subsidy. There are some fantastic programs in Africa from places like the UK government, the World Bank, CEDA. All of these places all of them have really great mini grid financing and subsidy schemes. But at the same time, you need that private capital to come in next to it in order to really make this happen, because mini grids are infrastructure. And so where you do have the public capital there in the sector, you need private capital to come in at scale and invest alongside of it. And we know that there's a $1 billion plus infrastructure capital market out there. And what we're trying to do is get Mini-Grids access to that type of capital and establish Mini-Grids as infrastructure assets.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So this is big business. So the deals that you do, they help people, and it's an incredible evolving market on the continent. And I think that's what makes your perspective here so interesting, because one thing that you didn't mention is that, you're a Buckeye like me, right? We both went to OSU, but also you have your MBA from Georgetown. You did a lot of energy work here in the States. And so your approach is going to be a very interesting and unique blend of what you learned here and your business experience here, along with your culture that you brought, with you, because you are Ghanaian, and what you've already learned through your work there. So I think it's going to be interesting to explore your unique approach to negotiation here. And so, listeners, what we're going to do is we're going to explore five key topics as it relates to negotiation that Humphreys recognized that are beneficial in knowing how to negotiate effectively on the continent. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out these gems of wisdom that you can apply in your everyday negotiation. So we're going to use Humphrey's experience essentially as a case study for all of us to learn more about what it means for us. And so the first thing that you mentioned, Humphrey, is that Africa isn't a monolith. And I think for some, we might need to say Africa isn't a country too. So when you think about Africa not being a monolith, what really comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about this and you were saying, look, I'd like to explore negotiating in Africa. And I sat and I thought about it. I was like, I don't know what I can tell you in general about negotiating in Africa. Africa is so many different things, right? I mentioned earlier, you've got 1.2 billion people, 50 plus countries, thousands of languages. You've got countries that speak English, French, Portuguese. You have the different legal systems, the different government types, economies. You have to look at every single country and every single culture and be quite specific in what you're talking about. So I couldn't look at you like with a straight face and say, okay, I'm an expert in negotiating in Africa. I mean, I have experience negotiating project finance contracts in certain African countries, but I think that's as far as I can actually go, honestly. And so that's really what I meant about Africa's not a monolith. And I think it's probably similar to whatever type of business you're in. It's just that you need to be specific. You need to get into the nitty gritty details, because at the high level, when you're talking in negotiations, it's usually just not sufficient.
Absolutely. And there's so many ways that we can look at this too. Right? Because we look at Africa, Africa is massive. Multiple countries, multiple languages, all these different cultures, right? It's really diverse. And then something similar happens sometimes when you might be negotiating with a company. You might say, oh, and people from this company negotiate in this way. But is it that you dealt with one specific person who negotiated in that way, a specific department? Because when you think about cultural intelligence, what you're recognizing is that culture is everywhere. So you have culture between countries, you have culture between communities, we have cultures even within organizations. And so the culture that is within the software or IT department within a company is going to be different from HR. And that might change the way that you interact with the person based on the unique culture that's in front of you.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think that there's kind of like a mixture there, right? Because like you said, is it a negotiation with that individual person, or is it their department or the whole company? And then when you have to separate that from the idea that, sometimes we think, okay, it's business, it's not personal. There is a personal aspect to it, right? We are dealing with an individual person, and how to properly separate that from, okay, is it the business? Is it the culture of an industry? Is it the culture of a department? I think it's sometimes not that easy to pick that apart properly, especially in a negotiation, which can be heated, and you're in the moment, and tempers can flare. Hopefully not, but your mind is moving, your blood is pumping, all of those together. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And based on your experience, what were some of the biggest surprises for you culturally as you started to get deeper into this?
Wow. I'm not even sure where to start. One of the things worth noting is that here negotiation in general is just, it's just a way of life, right? When I step out and if I want to go across town, it used to be more like this in cities in the States, but here you got taxis everywhere. But when I flag down a taxi, they don't have a meter inside of them. I flag them down. I say where I want to go. They look at me. They look at what I'm wearing. They hear my accent, et cetera, et cetera. And then they quote a price, right? Which then I need to try to cut in half and negotiate from there. And so one of the things that when you see negotiation just essentially as a way of life in that way is that one of the things that I've seen is people are willing and able and comfortable enough, I guess, in their negotiation to make very bold asks because, you know, why not, right? Just earlier today, my wife went to go buy some fish and she knew the price because her mother goes there often and the price is 25 cedis. The woman said, hey, this fish is 40 cedis. I mean, she did just from the way she spoke, the way she looked, and made an assessment and said, I'm going to try to sell you this for 40 cedis. Getting close to double the price. And luckily, I think something we can hit on later, preparation and having knowledge of the situation, she was able to say, no, it's 25 cedis. You know, my mother, this is the money for the fish that I ordered. Thank you. And I think we see it also kind of in the negotiations that we do on and the commercial negotiations in contracts for mini grids and or with investors on the continent is that you have folks that are more comfortable making these bold asks. And so I think that's one of the things that surprised me.
Hi, I'm Catherine Konapke, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer here at the American Negotiation Institute. Did you know our company offers completely customizable negotiation workshops? The negotiation and conflict resolution skills that your team will learn from these workshops are beneficial across all professions, but they're especially useful in procurement, purchasing, sales, sourcing, and contract management. Our calendar is filling up quickly, and we even have some workshops scheduled for next year. If you think you might want one, I'd suggest reaching out soon so you don't miss out. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Also, be sure to check out our YouTube, LinkedIn, and Instagram accounts to see our daily negotiation content. Thanks for listening.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it reminds me of one of our earlier episodes. We had an episode on the unique negotiation culture of India. And what I'm recognizing is that different cultures, different countries have more of a storied history of negotiation. Right, where it says, okay, this is how we communicate and talk. This is just how we engage in commerce, right? And I think that's surprising for a lot of folks in the U.S. And then when we think about it in the commercial space, it seems as though that culture of being comfortable asking for what you want plus a significant amount creeping in. And so what impact does that have on the actual negotiations?
I think there are a few things, right? So sometimes if you have a counterparty who is making these types of asks, it's just a matter of understanding the culture that you're in. And not becoming flustered, right? Not saying this is so far from what I'm used to or what I'm expecting that we can't close a deal because we're so far apart. Culturally, where culturally here in Africa, you have a lot of parties, individuals, companies, et cetera, who are used to starting like this and meeting somewhere in the middle. And so they will make that ask, or they will make a high anchor or a low anchor or something of that nature. And they'll do it remarkably well.
Yeah, no, that's great. That is really good to know. And listeners, you know, at some point it's always coming when I talk about the free guides. So if you go to AmericanNegotiationInstitute.com/guide, you can get access to all of our free guides. So business negotiation guide, and I know you're going to talk about negotiation preparation coming up here, Humphrey. But also we have an anchoring guide. I don't talk about that one very often, but it actually walks you through how to anchor effectively in your negotiation. So if you're saying to yourself, what is this term anchoring that Humphrey just said, check out that guide so you can use it because it's powerful. And what I'm recognizing too is if you don't understand that culture and you don't recognize that what you're dealing with is an anchor, an aggressive request where they're anticipating some pushback, then not only is it a situation where you could say, oh, we're too far apart, I'm just going to walk away, but it is it's also a situation where if you do decide to engage, you could be taken advantage of in that you're giving away more value than you need to.
Exactly. That's definitely a huge risk. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. That is really, really fascinating. And so one of the things that you talked about was being a foreigner coming here and starting to negotiate in the commercial space. There were some challenges, and building the relationship was critical for you. And so can you tell us a bit more about that challenge and what you were able to do to overcome that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, when we were talking about this, the idea was that, you know, typically what you might be used to if you're coming from a more Western culture will be, okay, we have a negotiation. The topic of the negotiation is X. You get on the call, you say hello, and you jump right into X, right? But here, I just found that, and maybe to caveat this, the types of negotiations that we're working on when we're building these mini grids, when we're investing in these mini grids and financing them, they're long-term relationships, right? Our contracts are for 10, 15 year relationships, right? And so culturally here, before you get into this 10 year contract, you really want to be comfortable with who you're working with. And so you have to build that relationship. You have to make sure that when you get on the calls, you take the time to have that polite banter. You ask about people's wives, you ask about their children, you invite people to your house, you go to their house. It has huge rewards professionally that you're able to build a relationship that you can structure a partnership on, and huge rewards personally. You get to meet great people. You get to learn amazing things about cultures that you're not as used to. And so I think that was one of the things that culturally for me, the idea that, okay, let me just take the time and build a relationship, and this being critical to the later nitty gritty negotiation, is something that I wasn't as used to.
Yeah. And what I'm seeing here is that there are levels to this game, right? Levels to when it comes to building this rapport. Because in the States, if you're in a Western style negotiation, we talk about building rapport. And I know sometimes in my trainings, I'll say, hey, take some time to build rapport. Just take 2-3 minutes, just with a little bit of pleasantries. But what you're talking about is different than what we would understand as building rapport, right? We're not just talking about those couple minutes at the beginning of the call. You're saying, no, we are investing in a relationship as the foundation before we move on to the business side.
Or while you're on the business side, right? I mean, it's not like you just have to only build the relationship and then get into business, but as you start and as you dip your toe into the waters of a potential partnership and a potential deal, you start to build that relationship. And if you find yourself in the same city as the people you're working with or negotiating with, then it definitely makes sense to, I mean, COVID is kind of almost made us forget what it's like to negotiate in person. But negotiating in person, chatting afterwards, coffees turn into lunches, barbecues, et cetera. And so I think, yeah, just building that relationship and investing time, it really isn't extremely, it's not different really from the rapport that you just mentioned. It's just taking it a few steps further if you can.
That makes sense. And for you as, it's so interesting for me thinking of you as a foreigner in Africa. But again, it speaks to the fact that Africa is not a monolith. And it's funny, when I go back and I visit my family in the Caribbean, there was a while in my life where I would go back and visit my family and they would say, "You sound American." Then I come back home to the States and they're like, "You sound Caribbean." I'm like, "Where is my home? I don't know." Like, who will have me?
Oh, wow. It's so funny you say that. That is, that's my experience, I guess, everywhere I go. I was in the States for Thanksgiving. I feel like a foreigner in the States sometimes. I'm in Ghana now. I'm in Ghana now. I've been here since before Christmas, and you know, I speak the language, but with a strange accent. and then I live in Kenya. And so in Kenya, I get, you know, I'm in these situations where, let's say I'm grocery shopping, people come up to me, they start speaking Swahili. They think I'm Kenyan, and then I speak English and they become quite disappointed. I do plan on picking up Swahili lessons for real in 2021. So that'll be a big piece, and that'll help me with the culture a lot, I hope.
Well, this actually brings up an interesting point, right? Because, I mean, let's just be honest about this, right? You're Black, right? So you would there, and you have a Ghanaian name. And so people would say, "Oh yeah, Humphrey, he's got an advantage here." But we're recognizing that there is still a distinction, right? There's still a bit of a barrier to rapport that you need to overcome. So based on your experience, what about if somebody was not Black? So somebody who is Asian, somebody who is white, somebody who is Latino, right? If they are now trying to have these high-level negotiations, what barriers have you seen and how could they be overcome?
Yeah, and so, yes, it's a great question. And so I guess given my experience, it's I don't know how well I can really speak to someone else's experience in those shoes, but I think that, I mean, in 2020, 2021, this time when it comes to, you know, understanding things like race and privilege and cultures and all of these things, it's definitely important to be cognizant of. I work with people from all over the world. Cross Boundary is a very diverse firm. We've got people from I don't know how many countries in our largest office, which is in Nairobi. And so I have plenty of people on my main team. Let's say has the guy who leads the team. He's from the UK, and he's having and leading quite a few complex negotiations on the continent with different parties, different counterparties from so many different places. He does a very good job of building that rapport. He's taking Swahili lessons. It's actually pretty impressive. He gets all over the country. He rides around on his motorbike. He's visited so many different places in the country and on the continent, and he generally does a really good job of building with rapport internally with the team. So with someone like me who has the background we just talked about, and then we have another person on our team who's Kenyan. And so, I mean, we're in a multicultural world, and so I think people have really just gotten great at understanding different cultures, building relationships with different cultures. And I don't know if it's really an Africa specific thing. It's just when you're doing global business, when you're doing the type of work that we're doing, you just have to learn to be very humble and to listen and to be willing to learn. I think those are some of the most important pieces of it.
Absolutely. And the thing is, when it comes to humility, that is a negotiation superpower, right? Because it is the thing that leads to curiosity. If you're humble, you're willing to step back and listen as well. And you're eager to learn. And you're willing to engage in order to learn. That's the thing. And that's what I found when I'm engaging in cross-cultural negotiations, and people would say, ooh, international negotiations? I'm like, no, well, not all of them. A lot of them are just local, but we have to identify culture. Like I discussed earlier, culture comes in many different ways. And so I think that's a really interesting example, right, of somebody who is clearly different in very obvious ways, but is willing to put forth the efforts to engage and learn and be humble, and it's paying dividends.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, humility is such a key part of a negotiation. I think I'd be embarrassed to tell you how the number of times that I've been wrong in a negotiation. And you just need to keep that in mind, no matter how sure you are. Well, not necessarily no matter, but a lot of times you have to keep in mind the idea that you could be wrong, right? Yeah. And that you need to go in humble and looking to learn with very open ears. And it's so critical to having an effective negotiation. And it also has a really calming effect on the discussion in general, right? Because you come off as very humble. It's very unlikely that that people get hot-headed. You can keep the conversation very constructive.
Awesome. And one other thing that I wanted to get to is the role of the public sector in these deals, because it's very different there than in other places. So can you take a second and tell us about that too?
Yeah, sure. And so just for a bit of context, back when I was in the States, I was in Ohio. I was working for the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, which regulates all of the investor-owned utilities in the States. So regulating the electric sector, natural gas, landline telephones, interstate transportation, rail, water. So regulating those, and I had a focus on electricity. And when I was there in Ohio at the time, some of the large utilities being, for example, Duke Energy, AEP, First Energy, AES was in the country, was in the state as well. And so these are publicly traded companies, large companies that are in competition with one another. In my role, we served as the regulator, right? Balancing the needs of the companies to get a competitive return, but at the same time, the needs of the customers to make sure that, you know, they're not being gouged from a price perspective, and balancing kind of the policy needs, let's say, of the governments at the time. Where I am now, so here on the continent, a lot of times, most countries have state-owned utilities, right? So we're not talking about competition anymore amongst competitive public-owned companies, but we're talking about a utility who is quasi-governmental, and doesn't really have competition in the same sense of what I'd be used to from my role at the PUCO. And you see that outside of just the electric sector. The governments, one of the things that's taken me a lot of time to learn and adjust to here is the role of government on the continent sometimes is just different than what I'm used to there. They can be more influential in business, and it's just really important to make sure you account for that. And so every time we are looking to do business in a new country, in a new jurisdiction, recognizing how important it is to make sure you have the right legal and regulatory context, learn from experience, sometimes the hard way. The first thing we do is always to get a good law firm on the ground in country and take our business model to them and ask them to do a legal and regulatory review of our business model and what we're trying to do, and ask them to say, look, what is everything we need to understand, right? What's the licensing process? What applies to us? We do a separate tax review. Going through this process, we have an idea of all of the legal and regulatory risks, all the entire process, everything that our business will be exposed to from a legal regulatory side. And just having that knowledge is so critical, especially in negotiations. So it's great. It's important. You know, you need to have it to properly set up the business, properly get moving. But in negotiations, when you're having those contract discussions, you need to have a very good regulatory context. It can definitely come back to bite you. if you don't.
Absolutely. And it makes so much sense too, because I think about even here domestically, as because I still practice because I want to keep my negotiation skills sharp. One of my biggest frustrations is when people call me in too late. You know, it's like, hey, Kwame, I negotiated this deal. Okay, did you consider the legal ramifications of said deal? No, I have not. Oh, so I'm playing from behind. That's fantastic. So I appreciate that. And I think it's so important and something that we should all take into consideration. But also specifically in your context, recognizing that you have to understand the game you're playing. Because if you just come in and think about this in terms of the energy deals that you're doing and the numbers and the payoffs and all that stuff, but you forget that regulatory context, then you're not playing the right game the right way. And even though you think you struck a really solid deal, like you said, it can come back to bite you in the end.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, that all of it comes down to, well, being humble and humble enough to realize there's a lot you don't know. And then from there, being prepared. And those, I mean, for me, when I think about if I go through kind of my top three, let's say general negotiation principles, it's important to be humble, be prepared, and be open. And by being open, I mean just being open to listening, being open to being wrong, being open to things you didn't think about, new solutions. And those three are so critical. And I'm sure we could even spend this whole podcast just diving into just those and how important it is to make sure you do those right.
Absolutely. And for the listeners too, for every episode, we do a pre-interview chat. And one of the things that I love to hear in the guests is when they say, you know, I mean, I don't know how much of an expert I am at this. And then I'm like, oh, yep. So he has the humility check. So that means probably a great negotiator, right? Because when you think about the success that you have had at this, you are clearly a good negotiator, but it's that mindset of humility that you bring to the negotiation that makes you such a good negotiator. And I think that philosophy is so great and so simple. And the thing that I like about the simplicity is that it's easy to remember, right? You know, those three things, those three principles, if you have that as the foundation, then that is a really solid foundation upon which you can build higher level negotiation techniques, which you do have.
No, I think you're right. And I like the way you framed that. I actually am humble, and but at least I like to think that I am. But I think that what really makes, I think, any negotiation effective maybe is the third one there, be open. Because listening and really being solution oriented, being open to being wrong, and also just it's a mindset, right? The idea that this is not a fight. I'm not going in to shove my ideas down someone's throat. I'm not going, and the reverse isn't happening to me either. I need to be open to learning. This is a learning opportunity. I need to understand what exactly is it that the counterparty wants, and how can I give that to them while still getting what I need. And so, and it's just, once you kind of flip into that mindset, it just opens your ears to all the different possibilities that can fit in that box of, I give them what they want and I still get what I need. And then you're good to go, essentially.
This is great. And think about how these three things play into each other too, right? You're prepared because you do something like, I don't know, download the free guides from the website, as I always talk about. And so then also you're humble, which leads you to be more curious. So you ask more questions. That curiosity gives you more information. And then you're open to new possibilities. And when you put all those things together, puts you in a better position to have creative deals. And that creativity gives you a greater likelihood of success, because the more paths to victory you have, the more likely you are to achieve a victory. And that creativity is a major aspect of effective negotiation. And so in your experience, how have you seen creativity really push deals over the edge?
No, that's a very interesting question, Kwame. And so maybe if we step back and frame kind of what we're doing at Cross Boundary Energy Access and what we're trying to do, right? We are trying to invest in mini grids and bring finance to mini grids like infrastructure. So if you think of something like a wind farm in Europe, what they have is you build the wind farm and then you have long-term inflation-linked cash flows that are essentially guaranteed or contracted from a credible off-taker. And that allows a debt provider or a lender to come in and say, look, this looks like a bankable project and I can lend money to it. Now, if we want to say we want to treat mini grids like infrastructure, but the issue is we don't have long-term inflation-linked cash flows from a credible off-taker. We don't have the government of Sweden on the opposite side of a power purchase agreement that has signed, let's say, 15-year deal to buy electricity, or 20-year deal, or 30-year deal to buy power from our plant that you put millions of dollars into. What we have are individual rural households, thousands of individual rural households in Africa who, these are often marginalized communities. And so they really only have the ability to pay, let's say, the equivalent of about $5 a month in electricity, and they don't have a contract, right? They're not saying, look, we're going to buy all the electricity. It's more on us to say, what we need to do is provide, high quality power, 24/7 power, and the type of power that allows you to be productive and to make money, essentially. The power that you can use for productive uses to run a grain mill or a barbershop or refrigerators and sell cold drinks, something to make money. And we need to have very reliable power, right? Because if you look across the world, once people get electricity, and if it's high quality electricity, it's quite addictive. You're going to keep using it, right? And so knowing that we don't have a contract with a credible off-taker, to pay this price over this period of time, we've had to be quite creative in how we line this up with infrastructure finance. The way we've approached that creatively with lenders, with financiers, with our counterparts, the developers, all of it together is kind of all in the secret sauce of how we make CBEA work. And I call it secret sauce, but it's actually not that secret. So what we did late at the end of last year is we essentially open sourced our approach. This is CBEA. It was kind of a pioneering pilot fund, first ever project financing for mini grids in Africa. And what we did is we open sourced it. We said we are putting out our term sheets for our project finance contracts, which are really critical to how you align incentives, our bankable project finance model as well, making that available, and then shared like a pretty extensive and detailed white paper that kind of says this is how we approach the challenges like this revenue risk, and these are the on the ground realities, these are the challenges that we still have, remaining risks, and we open source everything, and you can actually see everything on our website and see the whole breakdown of how we apply infrastructure project finance to these distributed mini grid assets.
Yes, so I think this is great. So we'll have links to all of that in the description. So the company's website, Humphrey's LinkedIn, and all of those things. And what I really appreciate about this is the power of creativity here, because you're in a world right now where you're blazing the trail, and so you are the rules, really, when it comes to the standard operating procedures for these negotiations. And then I feel like it's a very interesting business strategy as well to share the what could have been the secret sauce to making this happen. And so for your company, what's the strategy of being so generous with that approach?
Yeah, maybe a few things to unpack there, right? We wish we could say that we are the rules. I mean, we do feel like we are blazing the trail, but the fact is, infrastructure finance is something that is there. It's used on roads and bridges and power projects, et cetera, across the world. So the rules exist. What we're doing is we're taking something that isn't typically infrastructure finance and adapting it for those rules. So unfortunately, we don't get to make the rules, but we do have to be creative in how we apply the rules. Secondly, to why we decided to open source this. I mean, ultimately, when we open sourced our approach, we don't think it's necessarily the only way to finance mini grids. It's something, and we don't think it's perfect either. The idea here was that we tried something to bring mini grids in, to bring finance into mini grids at scale. We believe it works when you do it correctly. And so let's lay out exactly what that is. And mini grids, if you look at the, I think it's the IEA, they said between now and 2030, if we want to hit universal energy access, get everybody in the world electricity, we need $187 billion of investment into mini grids. CBEA's pilot fund doing this was $18 million, not even a drop in the water. And so we can't do it. We can't, even if we wanted to, we couldn't do it by ourselves. We need a lot of other entities like us out here, project financing mini grids, finding new solutions to the risks that we're all trying to solve, and injecting capital at scale into the sector to bring power to 600 million people. I think it's similar to if you look at something like Tesla, right? And they said, look, we know that we need a cleaner way for people to be able to drive cars. We think we have a solution. These vehicles we make, it's not necessarily the only solution, but it works best at scale. So why don't we put the information out there? Why don't we open source it? Say we're all trying to solve the same problem, and maybe we can have our solution gain scale and benefit from that. And so and ultimately hit the big goal, which is let's have people drive less dirty cars. And so that's what we're trying to do. So I think that's kind of the mentality behind it. We're really proud of that work. And we're excited about what's coming from it.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. And I know we're a little bit beyond what a typical episode is, but I mean, Humphrey, that's your fault for being so fun to talk to.
Apologies.
So the last point is talking about the role of foreign exchange in these deals. And so when we think about foreign exchange, first of all, what is it in this context and why is it so important?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely critical. So let's say you're in the United States and you're doing a deal. A dollar is a dollar, so you don't really have to worry about converting currencies. But here, let's say we're doing a transaction in Zambia, right? A lot of the finance that we raise, our equity and debt capital that we're bringing in, is typically hard currency, U.S. dollars, right? So we have dollar-denominated debt. But as we described the business model of a mini grid, you have rural households in Zambia paying you per kilowatt hour for electricity, and they're paying you in kwacha, the Zambian kwacha. Now I'm earning kwacha, and I'm using it to pay back dollar-denominated debt. Maybe a good example is if you look in 2020, for example, the Zambian kwacha devalued 50%. So if you're in that scenario, and now all of a sudden the value of what you're earning just dropped significantly, how do you pay your debt? So foreign exchange is something that you really, really need to keep in mind when you're looking at business on the continent. You have the Zambian kwacha, which is a free floating currency, but then you have other currencies that maybe the central bank has a bit more firm hand on that currency. And even there, you can have different types of problems. So in 2020, for example, the Naira there was a slight devaluation, but not that much. But at the same time, you had a lot of transfer and convertibility risk. You simply weren't, if you were, a lot of companies struggled to get their Naira out of the country in dollars, right? So if you have Naira and you have dollar denominated debt outside the country, making that switch, it was very hard to do, to turn your Naira into dollars. Still some challenges there. So just really understanding that you're not dealing with apples and apples. It's not dollars and dollars, right? So you have to understand how the different currencies relate to each other, how inflation might work, how depreciation of the value of whatever currency you're working in might work, and apply that to your project very thoughtfully. And then also think, hard about how you mitigate these risks, right? Do you need to have hedges in place? Do you need to raise your debt in local currency and not have dollar denominated debt? I think this is one of those things where there's no real silver bullet. It's really a matter of having a good amalgamation of different options and bringing them together and working very closely with your partners on a transaction, whether it be your lenders, whoever your equity investors, everybody, and trying to say, how do we put together a view, an understanding of how we will approach foreign exchange. But it is a critical piece of business on the continent and really in frontier markets all over the world, because FX is huge in these places.
Wow. Yeah, that's got to be challenging. And especially as a lawyer, I think about a lot of these deals in terms of risk, right? And risk mitigation and things like that. And so that sounds terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And so is it a situation where there have been deals that have been lost simply because of the concern of foreign exchange?
I would have to assume yes. I mean, in general, yes. The concern of foreign exchange makes people or companies or entities not want to invest in certain countries at all, right? Or if you're looking. If you're looking at a deal in a country while it's going through a currency crisis, it would definitely make you consider whether or not that investment still makes sense. I mean, FX, when you put it into an Excel and a financial model and you start to play with it, really what it means is I was going to buy this thing for, let's say, $1 million. But when FX changed in this way very drastically, it's only worth half that, or it's only worth 75% of that. And the value of it changes. And like you said, it's very difficult from a risk perspective, because it's not really anybody's fault. And so it's a risk it becomes a very difficult and challenging conversation to say, okay, this has happened. How do we deal with it? Who's impacted by it and why? It can definitely require some very creative solutions. And like I said, there's no silver bullet here. So there are options out there, but this is one of the things. If you look into the open source documents, you'll see that this is one of the ones where we've kind of put out there, like, this requires some more thought on how we fix these solutions.
Makes sense. Wow. Yeah. So there is a lot to think about. But I appreciate you taking the time to help us think about it, and not just help us to get a better understanding of how these deals go down on the continent, but also how these general negotiation principles can apply to whatever it is that we're doing, wherever we happen to be. So I appreciate you taking the time there. And before you go, Humphrey, can you remind them again about where you work, how they can get in touch and learn more about what it is that you're doing?
All right. So the company that I'm at is called Cross Boundary. The Cross Boundary Group's a mission-driven investment organization that's focusing on using the power of capital and having it make both a lasting impact and a strong return in frontier markets. And so if you want to learn more about Cross Boundary, you can check out the website, www.crossboundary.com, on Twitter, at Cross Boundary. We have a number of teams working in frontier markets on very interesting problems all across the world. If you want to just check out the website, it's an interesting place to learn about the different ways that capital is being put to work in these types of markets around the world. And then my team is Cross Boundary Energy Access. We focus on mini grid project finance, and we have a facility for doing that. If I can just wrap, if I can just think of like a few key takeaways from my side, maybe one is that, if the idea is, okay, I want to understand investing in Africa, I would urge you to be much more specific. Do you want to understand investing in Kenya? And investing itself is too broad. So do I want to understand project finance in Kenya? Do I want to understand stock markets in Kenya? Do I want to understand equities or debt? Or how do you want to, you just need to be much more specific. Africa is not some broad monolith that someone can go in. And there are very few people who can just say, I'm an African negotiations expert, because I'm like, what type of negotiation? Because you can be great in all of these, all of these debt equity negotiations, investment negotiations. But when you're trying to buy fish in the market, that's a whole different type of negotiation. And so, yeah, I think keep that in mind. And then when negotiating in general, always be humble, be prepared, and be open.
Love it. Thank you so much, my friend, for coming on the show. Can't wait to have you back.
All right. Would love to be back. Thanks so much, Kwame. It's been a pleasure chatting, catching up, talking, and thanks so much for having me on your show.
Congratulations, you've just joined an elite club. By listening to a full episode, you're now officially on the Negotiate Anything team. So welcome aboard. What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast, because that allows them to automatically get the latest episodes of the show. The best things in life lie on the other side of difficult conversations. Keep learning, keep practicing, and keep getting better. Your relationships will improve, your career will soar, and you'll have the confidence you need to get the most out of these crucial conversations. Again, thank you for joining the team. We're excited to have you, and I will see you in the next episode. I'll catch you later.